lucky to have Tess here talking to us. Her speech is entitled Going Within, a Practical Approach. So I'm going to give a little bit of background on Tess. She grew up on a farm where death was a part of life. Animals, there were lots of animals who were born, they grew old, and then they died. In fact, her mother told her that everything which is born dies, and Tess seemed to just accept that. But one day her father came in and announced that a baby, a young calf, had died, which was a deep shock to Tess. She reasoned, if a calf can die, a child can die. If a child can die, I can die at any moment. And this threw her into a tailspin and was the start of her spiritual journey. Over the next few decades, Tess questioned a lot of things in her own way, and she even went to school studying general science to see if the answer was there. By the time that Tess found Tat, she'd given up the hope of ever finding anything. She'd resigned herself to living just a life of dullness. Though she had everything that she'd wanted, she still wasn't fulfilled. So she actually discovered Tat by Googling an ex-boyfriend named Richard Rose. And she was surprised to find, if I'm not mistaken, a lot of integrity and clear thinking in Tat that she hadn't found anywhere else. She felt there was something there. And she flew out eventually here, and I think you brought a friend, right? Because you're just in case that everyone here was axe murderers or
weirdos that I needed to.
What I personally really like about Tess's approach is that she creates quirky little experiments that they just seem to have a lot of meat to them, and that it's really exciting to hear about how our mind works. So it's my pleasure to introduce Tess.
Thank you. And I'm going to start with a comment which struck me last night, and it was that I think I'm the first of the second wave of TAT teachers, I call myself, meaning I'm the first person teaching who has not met Mr. Rose. So we're hoping that the second wave will be a fine big wave of people. When I was doing this, when I was putting it together, I found myself thinking about the first time I came to TAT in 2005 and how I felt sitting in the audience like you. And I mean, I'd been reading the website and I'd been reading for decades and all the rest, but I still didn't know what I was at. I wasn't clear. So I had come, I was hoping to get some clarity, understand what I was at. I knew I couldn't stop what I was at, but I didn't know what I was at. So I know we have some new people here today, and you know, you're really welcome, and I just wish that it works out for you the way it did for me, that you get the kind of clarity and that you do the work that's required to do it. So and especially for the new people who came, I'm going to read this at the top of your of the sheet, and I'm going to suggest that you keep this with you and bring it back to remind you when you lose clarity or when you forget what you're at. And I'm going to read it out. The ultimate aim of meditation is to go within. Going within means to find reality by finding the real part of ourselves. I think that's an extraordinary statement. Just to give you an idea of what you're at. Finding reality by finding the real part of ourselves. So that's what we're after with the spiritual path and anything we're doing. That's the main goal, that's the direction we're going. Once we begin to meditate in the attempt to go within, we should simply observe ourselves. We cannot do it simply. It is a very profound task or attempt. It does not matter if you believe all of this or not. It only matters that you look inside. Do it. Don't bother trying to explain it or whatever. Just do it and the questions will come up. Find out for yourself who your ultimate observer is. That's so succinct and so on the ball that I think newcomers certainly should keep this with them and reread it and think and see how you feel about it today and see how you think about it next year. Has anything happened between now and a year's time as to your understanding of what the real part is or what reality might be? So the title of this is A Practical Approach. So how do you go about going within? Well, the very fact that we use the phrase going within means there must be something that we have some idea of inside and outside. So what's inside and what's outside? And again, it's probably a good thing in your own time to test this in your own way. So I'm just kind of giving you generalities here, really. So the world is outside your skin. And what do you say is inside? You say my thoughts, my emotions, my actions. So we claim these kinds of things to be our own, and we don't claim that the outside world is ours. So just making that distinction and being aware of it for yourself. Now, it's not just a clean cut, because there's traffic back and forth, of course, between them. I mean, our actions are on the outside world, what we do. But there's also inner action. What are you doing inside? You know, there's my actions and so on. What would inner action be that's going on? What are you doing in there? So inner action, going within. So what I've just put here is conscious action, meaning it's something that you deliberately do. You know, rather than having automatic thought patterns, which is what happens most of the time, we just have the same thought patterns. We just do the same thing over and over again. We're programmed just to keep doing the same things. You know, go to the same coffee shop, I have coffee every morning, I have whatever. Just programmed actions. So the idea is to look at what you're doing. Why am I doing this? Why? Noticing your own patterns is what I'm talking about here, and basically doing something different. But you have to notice them before you can start doing something about them. So what you're doing here, another way of putting it, is you're bringing what's unconscious into consciousness. Noticing the ways in which you're unconscious or robotic. And the thing is, you don't notice it. You have to consciously look for this, because it's what I've always done. It's what I do. It's what we do in this country. It's what we do around here. So to start looking at things like that, to see in what ways you're just repeating the same things over and over. And when I talk about conscious action, I'm thinking about it at two different levels, we could say, or maybe two different stages. So first off, becoming yourself, by which I mean becoming a healthy, normal human being. A lot of times people have their emotions suppressed. You know the way when we're kids, you're told, oh, you know, you don't feel that or you don't think that. So I'm really talking about ordinary, everyday human conditioning. And it seems to me that it's necessary to free oneself up to some extent from the suppressed emotions. But what I'm really just saying here is freeing ourselves up from the tight conditioning, loosening the conditioning that we have been brought up with. That's a place to start. You can't start with saying, oh, I'm going to look for reality within myself without looking. You have to look at what there really is. What do you know for yourself? However trivial it is, you have to look at what seems real for you in your ordinary everyday experience and in what ways you're suppressing yourself or whatever it is. And secondly, the second part of it, and this is really what Tat is talking about, this is what the spiritual path is about. It's about becoming yourself. Actually, what you're doing is you're removing what's false. You can't aim for becoming yourself. And by this, I mean what we might call God or whatever. So this part is the spiritual path, and I would say this is just becoming psychologically mature and becoming your normal, what's normal for you. Not just a packaged kind of person in society. And this actually happens, I think, fairly automatically to people as they get older. The pure knocks of life or just experience. You know, the way you say you just become more comfortable with yourself. And I think the women all know this much more. You're just becoming more comfortably themselves. And you get that in place, and then something else begins to open up for you. There's still something the matter or whatever. And that's what we're talking about here. Becoming yourself. And notice I didn't say understanding yourself. It's a becoming. Now you do need to have, everything is involved. The thoughts, the actions, the emotions, the whole lot. Literally I'm talking about a transformation that happens. So becoming your small self. Becoming able to be free and whatever that is. So loosening conditioning. And I think that nowadays, anyway, most people, by the time you get as far as TAT, you've already been doing lots of therapies. Therapies on the body, psychological therapy, doing whatever. I think all of those help us to question, you know, why am I so unhappy? Why am I so shy? Whatever. We're going to try and heal our basic discomforts, and any kind of therapy, and I reckon they all help. You know, whatever works for you, would be my attitude. But what I want to talk about here is, which is the business of the spiritual path, becoming yourself. So assuming that this has reached a stage that it's okay, you're functioning. That's basically all you're at. Becoming yourself, which is the spiritual path. And I thought, since this is a practical approach, I thought I'd sum it up as prayer, meditation, self-inquiry, and dreams. Now, I had the first day when I arrived into Boston about a month ago, the first thing that happened was a woman picked me up and she said, listen, I need to go to the launch of a book. You know, do you want to come with me or not? And I thought, well, should I go to the launch of a book? And it was this book, and the title of it was Eat, Drink, and Remarry. I loved the title, and I read the book. Actually, it's quite good. It's all about relationships, our marriage relationships, and so on. And I thought, oh my God, there's a slogan going around nowadays, a nice thing, you know, like eat, pray, love. What's the other one? Eats, shoots, leaves. And then I noticed when I was in McDonald's one day, they had it as well, three things like that. I thought, well, now, maybe I should come up with something for what we're at. So what I came up with is pray, meditate, contemplate. So contemplation meaning self-inquiry. But anyway, pray, meditate, and contemplate is the shorthand for this talk or for what we're at. So, because I'm a visual person and I used to be a science teacher, I always needed a blackboard and something on it. So I thought I'd make a visual imaging for if there's anybody else like me as to what we're doing here. So, you can call this the ego or the separate self, that sense of I that we have. And it's basically defenses that we've learned in order to cope in the world. Because sometimes people say to me, well, maybe we could save kids from this. No, you can't save kids from this because they wouldn't survive very long if they didn't have defences against the world. And it's absolutely necessary. But what happens is we build a wall, these defences that we have, you know, always protecting ourselves, our self-image, you know, fear of rejection and that kind of thing. So what fears rejection? This here fears rejection from the world. So I'll just refer to that as the I or the ego or some language like that. And it forgets. It's so isolated. And this is where people get into real trouble. We're so isolated from what we really are that we forget about it completely. We've lost our connection with, and you can use whatever word works for you, God, the Absolute. Now, there is no, this line shouldn't be there, but I just think that the human mind needs a way, you know, you can't think about the infinite. So, you know, I would just say, well, okay, I'll just put a line there to help me think, because the mind needs to think within some kind of a container. It's not really there, but for the purposes of how you talk to yourself, or how you think, you know, how you're going to work with yourself, it would be helpful for me to have a line like that. So this thread is never lost. It couldn't be. It's not just a thread, it's the whole thing, but just to think about it, it couldn't be broken. But since we think it's broken, I've just put some lines there that it's, we feel broken, we've lost our connection with who we really are, with ourselves, that's what goes on. And of course, it doesn't go up this way. The ray doesn't go up this way. The ray comes down this way. And I just put a thing there saying that this is where intuition comes from. So, something from outside the world. Now, I probably should have had a thing around here saying the world or something in between it, but not to complicate it. I just wanted to leave a visual image. So, we often hear about prayer. And people say, well, what does it mean to pray? So what is somebody doing? And, you know, very many of the religions, that would be where they put their emphasis. But I notice when you look deeply into the religions, they may have an emphasis on one thing, but they're doing the meditation and the self-inquiry as well, even if they haven't called it that name. So what I would say prayer is about, it's communion with the self. So did I put it here someplace? The image I had was small self making a connection with big self. Trying to find that ray, trying to make some connection. So self talking to self, something like that. Again, when I was in Boston a couple of weeks ago, I came across a book just the day after I had thought of this, and the title of the book was Prayer, and it had been written by somebody called Kirpal Singh, who is a Sikh who was in the States at one stage and had set up an ashram. And so I looked to see what he had to say about prayer. And what he said in the book was there's three types of prayer. He said there's vocal prayer, mental prayer, and spiritual prayer. And I read his descriptions of it, and it struck me that they're not three types of prayer. They're three stages of prayer. That once you start praying, it doesn't just stay in the same arena. It changes. And I say this on the basis of my own experience. So and I thought about, well, what's vocal prayer? I mean, oftentimes we think of it, you know, it's just begging letters to God, is how I think of it. But any time you're reading spiritual books or anything like that, and you may even, you know, verbalize things for yourself, or you can use, many people would have a prayer, you know, prayer of St. Francis or something like that, where somebody else has vocalized something. And it's just a way of getting you started, giving you an idea of what kind of way to think. How do you think? Because small self has lost contact with this self, so it's just nothing. It's just a vacuum, you know. So how am I going to do this? So it's basically a kind of start. This is kind of like fake it till you feel it, you know. Start sending letters. Start sending out thoughts, or start thinking about this self, or whatever word you use. What I found after some period of time, I've told some of the people who are here, something happened. Which I would now label as mental prayer, which was, I had the idea came to me one day to read one of Richard Rose's books. I had read it about 5 years before. I have it underlined, and I had questions and all this. I was reading it looking for information, but the next time I read it, the idea was this was a personal letter to me from Richard Rose. It would be too much to get a personal letter from God, I suppose. So Richard Rose intervened and said, this is a personal letter to you. Now forget all rationality about all the other people who read it. This is just for you. And I would find that as I read, you know, read a paragraph or something, I found myself saying, well, I don't agree with you about that, or what, this kind of thing. And this voice in my head, which I said thought was Richard Rose, expanded on the idea. So over a space of about a week, I had this conversation with Richard Rose, which was a debate about the psychology of the observer. And I'll just tell you this bit here. Richard Rose was very much on for promoting celibacy. And when it came to that part, I said, I don't agree with that, whatever. And he answered right back, maybe it doesn't apply to you, Tess. And remember, I was dealing with a bunch of young lads. Skip a couple of pages. Literally. It's not an issue for you. I was dealing with a bunch of young lads. And I had never before thought of the, you know, who came to him were a bunch of young lads, because I only met them as older men. So I actually hadn't thought of that. So a conversation that might arise between you and a spiritual book or something that might seem valuable to me, to you, that would just arise when you're just going back and forth with it. I consider that to be mental prayer. Or that's what I mean by it. Now, after that, so we're looking for self. Something arose in me as an energy that had not been there before. when I say an energy, a feeling, a richness or something. And this was with me all the time. And I was a bit surprised when it came at first. And I recognized it as a female energy. Although Art challenged me about how I knew it was female, I said it was just so like me. But it turns out actually it had announced itself as female, which I had forgotten. And I just gave it the name Universal Mother. I just put a label on it for the sake of, you know, my mind needed a name to put on something, just to think with itself. And I called that Universal Mother. So after this then, you know, I had conversations with Universal Mother, which would be, you know, when I'd be just going around the house. So you could say it was like I would think of something and then a surprising thought would come back from somebody else. It had a different quality. And it came to a stage where my thoughts, what I thought were my thoughts, test thinking, and Universal Mother's thoughts literally morphed into each other. So Universal Mother and I, our test, became one. And so what I thought, she thought. You know, it wasn't like I and she. I suppose at first I probably noticed that. So I could say that every thought I had and every action I had was prayer. That, and I had it written there somewhere, but it was, there was a quote, isn't there? Something like, you know, make every action a prayer. That was really what happened, you know, and I was consciously aware of it for a period of time, that everything I did was we. It was no longer a we. It was a different I that had happened there. So that's what I mean by prayer developing. But if you don't get started and start doing something and have the idea, I'm trying to make connection with that thing that I don't know. Just kind of trust it until, I mean, that's what all the great teachers are saying, there is something, and even though you don't know it, well, you know, just trust the teachings that there is something, and maybe this is a way to go about finding this within yourself. And some ideas that go along with prayer, you know, which you'll find in any book is, you know, having gratitude. And, you know, basically this is an antidote to complaining. You know, you find yourself complaining about this, that and the other, you know, maybe just think, well, maybe there's something wrong here, maybe I could find gratitude for that, or acceptance. Even if you can't stop complaining, maybe you can find acceptance. Prayer, well, frequency. I mean, if you only write a, make a frantic phone call to the self, you know, when things are done, and you don't make any frantic, you don't do it until the next frantic phone call, there isn't going to be much of a connection. So just do it. You know, it doesn't have to be long. It's more to do with the sincerity and the intention of what you're doing than long periods of kneeling, you know, kneeling down. Pray without ceasing. It becomes that. I mean, I could never have started out here doing praying without ceasing. It became that. Just everything became a prayer. So, meditation. Art said this to me, that Richard Rose's definition of meditation was productive thinking. That's not what we think nowadays when we hear somebody is going to meditate, or, you know, you say, what kind of meditation are you doing, or this kind of thing. But I took out the dictionary and I looked up the word meditate, and actually it gives all the words that you would, including inquiry, inner inquiry. I think it was a thesaurus I looked up. So he was using the word accurately according to the dictionary definition. Although nowadays, and this, he probably got it before we had the wave of Eastern teachers come in and start teaching different techniques of meditation. But his use is accurate. So I would say there's two types of meditation generally. There's relaxation meditation. And, you know, when somebody is stressed and upset, you know, there is great value to learn some technique in which to calm yourself down and to relax yourself. And I know that in some of the, when I did Goenka Vipassana at one stage, and they always start like with about 5 minutes of just getting centered and being here now and time to settle down by following the breath. I think they did it in that. And I think that's, don't skip it. Because sometimes people say, oh, I sit down and my head is all over the place. Well, did you spend 5 minutes getting centered in your body and so on? You don't have to stay there, but to get things settled down. So that's what I mean. It's very valuable thing. And then insight meditation. Well, there are various kinds of techniques for that, you know, and well, Vipassana, insight, or checking things out, or whatever. I'm not going to go into that. The particular style of meditation, and the Douglas Harding people wouldn't agree with me anymore about this, but Douglas said in his book that seeing, his the technique that he had developed was meditation for the marketplace. And I latched onto that phrase because I was always so undisciplined. I mean, God knows how many times I learned a new form of meditation and I was going to do it forever, and 3 days later I'd have forgotten it. I just wasn't one of those people that was disciplined or able to do it. So I thought, seeing, meditation for the marketplace, there's my man now. So in 2007, I went to their retreat, and somehow, once I got seeing, I knew what it was. It was basically a subtle perceptual shift in myself. That's all I can say. There was a subtle shift. And it was so subtle that you might easily pay no attention to it or overlook it. But Douglas is writing. He writes and writes and props you up with this and tells you the difference between your seeing from the self's perspective, he might say, to from the ego perspective. And he keeps on spelling out what the differences between the two of them are. And of course, I would even say that our brains are wired neurologically to see or to look at the world from the ego perspective. But if you just do this little shift that you know, it's a challenge in some way, or it's an opening up of the neurons in the brain, something like that. But without constant reminder and without the backup of his writing, I think I wouldn't have been able to do it. But I was just very persevering about it. I just kept doing it and doing it and doing it. And a time came then in which I'd be seeing, and I was conscious of this, seeing and then ego, seeing and ego. Well, I'm this, the ego, I'm this, the seer, I'm this. Well, after a while, after it had settled and was an actual experience for me between the two, of course, then you start thinking, well, am I this or am I this? I can't be two of them. What is this one? So actually, he's playing with your identification there. Where's what are you identified with? What do you think you are? And this is a challenge to what we normally think. For me, I think there's a great lot of value to being aware of your body sensations and your emotions. Actually taking time to learn the landscape. What's the landscape of my body? There's sensations. As long as we're in a body, any living organism has sensations associated with its living to help it survive. But us humans, we also have sensations that come from the inside, from our thoughts, which is what are called emotions. And to just know in your own body where, to be able to distinguish between the sensations that are just to do with a living organism and the sensations that are caused by thoughts, emotions, just to make that distinction for yourself. So, I mean, what we're at here is trying to start getting some discernment about ourselves, finding some way to, some kind of a tool, some kind of a map to look at ourselves. And I think the body is a perfectly good place to start and to become discerning about, you know, where your own emotional things are held, because you can literally notice them at any moment or in any place. And that is a way of looking within the body, or getting started with it. Somebody said, one of the Richard Rohr's phrases was, the view is not the viewer. Well, this couldn't make out, the view is not the viewer. What in God's name is he saying? So one time when I was at TAT, and I hadn't really noticed this, because I was perfectly good at dismissing anything that I couldn't get at all. I don't know what he's talking about. I'll go on to the next bit, see do I get something. But Art was talking to somebody, and somebody must have asked him about this, and he's gesticulating, but the view, see, what do you see? And he's doing all of this kind of stuff. And I was standing back someplace, and I was looking at him, and thinking, I don't know what he's talking about, but it must be very important. He's doing everything he can to get this across. And I wasn't getting it, but I made a note of it. I must check out this. What's the viewer? So then I would find myself sitting, you know, doing something, and this is what I would be at. I think it was a kind of meditation, trying to check out, well, that's the view, and that's the view. Now, why is that important? It was like, well, that's obvious, isn't it? But anyway, so I just put that in there because I think that was a useful, I think that was a useful thing for me to have tried to struggle with that and deal with it. And in fact, it did become more obvious to me what it was, kind of like a koan, you would say, that I was trying to get what it was. I just put there, you know, that sometimes I think of meditation as taking a holiday from the ego, but I was thinking more up at this level, because when people get into, you know, people love meditation. You know, I know lots of people that, I meditate every day, I really love it, I really miss it. And so they're doing this for 40 years and nothing is progressing. So I think that certain kinds of meditation, they're basically, it feels good because you've taken a holiday from the ego, but as soon as you get off holidays, you know, half an hour later or an hour, right, you're right back with the trouble. So I just thought I'd make that image about it. Now, so self-inquiry, which is the method that Tat really perfects or uses or helps us with. Well, it helped me with it because I had no idea how to look at myself, even the idea of looking within in various ways. So, what do we see? I don't remember one word I've written here, so I have to read it to see what was I thinking when I put this up here. Thoughts, beliefs, assumptions. You know, you hear people talking about observing the thoughts or seeing the thoughts. Well, the very fact that you recognize that you can see a thought, what is it that seeing the thought? Do you know, even to have noticed that before I can see my thoughts, I can see my emotions. There's something about that. And beliefs, they're the things that I suppose a lot of times we don't even notice them. I mean, I noticed for myself as an Irish person, it was only when I travelled abroad that I realised that sometimes people thought a different way. And, you know, I just got challenged by doing that. I wouldn't have called it a challenge. It was just a surprise that some people think in a different way. But so it can come up any place. I mean, somebody saying something on television or anything and you can notice they think a completely different way to me. How do I think in relation to that? So just ways like that of actively chasing down your own beliefs, because they tend to run automatically unless you start to say, I'm actually trying to find what it is I believe about this. Or, and one of the ways you know beliefs is there are thoughts that don't have any emotional attachment and there are thoughts that have an emotional attachment. You know, so if you find you're getting yourself upset because somebody says, makes some remark, whatever it is, and you realise you're upset about it, well, why am I upset about it? What do I believe about that? And I put the word assumptions there because I found with myself, I never knew I had an assumption until I was challenged. They're just there. It's only when somebody or something happens that is a contradiction to it that you actually realise, oh, it was just a running. So, the kinds of questions, the way you might approach this for yourself, a way to start with it, you might find yourself saying to yourself, well, why do I think that? Why do I think whatever it is? And I'm always saying the spiritual life is daily life. You don't have to go off any place. Literally your daily life, it's the fodder for inquiry. How do I decide on things when you have competing desires? Ever notice yourself trying to decide about something? And you know, just to be aware of what's going on there. How do you? And the thing is, we're making decisions all day, every day. Mostly, I used to think really that I only made decisions when a big thing came up, and I hadn't really noticed that I was making decisions all day, every day. You go to the shop to do the grocery shopping for the family, and you know, you just do that because I know this one needs that and that's healthy for them. So actually, you've made decisions, and there are reasons for what those decisions are. They're based on. They're based on whatever values you have. What do I believe about? If there's nothing coming up for you, you can literally provoke yourself by just coming up with something. Well, what do I believe about? What something that interests you, or even something that doesn't interest you that much? What contradicts this belief? In other words, what would be the opposite? I used to do things like I would just play a game that, you know, I'd see somebody on television and they're talking politically or whatever, and then I would think, well, how would it feel to be that person saying those things and making those kind of gesticulations? What would it feel to be like? And I must say that afterwards, when Art used to write to me and there'd be some sentence in the thing, I used to do the same thing, like, well, now what kind of a state or position would you be in that you would say that? So I was trying to try to feel like, where's he coming from with this? But I think if you hadn't kind of tried it out with other people, you mightn't know how to find that for yourself. What am I thinking about now, this minute? Sometimes just catching a quick slice. Sometimes it's, what have I been thinking about for the last hour? My head has been taken up, you know, going round and round with whatever. And then, can I catch this minute? So long-term streams and short-term ones. Just see what's going on with that. What are my repetitive thought patterns? You notice the same thing is coming up again and again, the same old issue, whatever it is. If there are repetitive thought patterns, in the same way as if there are repetitive dreams, I think you should take a look at them and see what is going on here, what's the driving force behind it. It might be an old injury that maybe you need to go and have some kind of therapy, is what I'm saying. You know, issues about things that happened in the past. It might be that until you've worked through them. But it might be something like, you know, you find yourself there and you're thinking, every time something comes up about death, I always got hooked in. You know, if it was an accident and a load of people were killed, if I heard somebody else was dead, you know, it just always, I couldn't think about it because I couldn't find words about it. But I noticed that this was the thing in the background always. And what triggers thoughts? So you find yourself thinking about something. Where did it come from? Did it come from something outside? Did the world trigger thoughts? I mean, you might have a thought that you notice you're hungry. Oh, I'm hungry. That's come from the body. You might be watching television and something, and then you start thinking about whatever the political situation. So those thoughts came from outside. And maybe there are some thoughts that don't seem to have been caused by the world. They just arose for no seeming reason. Pay attention. Something inside, and see. Just so learn to notice. If you notice where they're coming from, then you're more likely to notice that they may have come from a different dimension. So I just made an image here, just thinking of the mind as a bowl. So this is about the passing contents, the arising and passing contents of the bowl. But is the bowl affected by its contents? The contents keep changing, or maybe they don't, or maybe some contents in it you'd prefer they weren't there at all. But have a look. So just the image of a bowl and thinking of the contents that are passing by, arising and passing. You don't have contents in the bowl and it's sitting there and nothing happening. There's constantly something going on there. And just basically looking at the contents or noticing when they change. We usually don't notice when something falls out of the bowl and it's gone. We only notice what's in it. But over time, you know, all you have to do is think back when you were 5 years old and you were thinking about dolls and whatever. So they were the contents of the bowl then, and they're not now. And I would say that over time with myself, you know, my mind, the contents of this bowl was all to do with family and job and teaching and all the rest. And with my various reading and coming to Tat and that kind of thing, a large part of this bowl had spiritual thoughts in it. Questions and wondering about that were the thought streams that would come up one way or another. So the contents can change. Do change. Not can. Definitely do. So again, just as a way to be looking at yourself, or a way to start getting within. If emotions are what are, if that's what catches your attention first. I was one of these people that always knew my emotions before I knew my thoughts. Actually, I thought emotions caused thoughts, which is not so. It's the other way around. There's a missing step there for me. So I found that I could use my emotions to go backwards and basically see what I thought. So how do you know when you're experiencing an emotion?
You feel it.
where do you feel it?
In the body or in the whatever you take yourself to be.
Well, I mean, in the body, and where in the body, and how do you know that that sensation is an emotion or not? Just to, what I'm saying here is look for yourself and see how do you know with it. There are also, well, I'll just make a distinction later on, some body sensations, to distinguish in which ones. And a lot of times we have emotional patterns like going around like this always. And, you know, if your shoulders are up and your body is not at rest, there's something going on. So I'm not talking... Sometimes, you see, with emotions is that they just arise and they pass, but sometimes we're holding them for so long that we don't even notice. But we can see them in other people. I mean, you can look at somebody else's face and you can see if it's drawn and so on, or you can see if it's up. They mightn't see it themselves. So just get to know those things that are so familiar that you don't notice them. That's really what I'm after here. So... positive and negative emotions. Nobody ever complains about positive emotions. These are the ones that get our attention, and I suppose we need to deal with them to the point where we're functional and able to manage. And when I wrote that, then I thought, is there such a thing as a neutral emotion? I have no answer to this myself, but just the thought of, is there such a thing as a neutral emotion? So looking at emotional patterns as they arise, well, there's the intensity. That's one of the qualities of emotions. You know, there's a big difference between in intensity, between being in a rage and being irritated. Or they come in the same scale. Is there something that just, I mean, do you just feel happy once in a while, or do you just feel in a rage once in a while, or is it something that's a kind of an ongoing thing, the background, a low background of it? So just look at the frequency, just notice for yourself, does this come up often, is this unusual, is this kind of the background against which I live, and are they repetitive, are there things that repeat themselves for you? And the thing is that this really is different for each person. We assume that everybody else has some kind of a similar emotional life to ourselves. Not so. People have very different emotional lives. And it can change drastically over time. I can tell you that from experience. From being distraught to being flat to whatever. And I can say those things happened in my life. Now, I'm making a little distinction here, which I think is an important distinction, actually. It's the difference between emotions and feelings. And I just made this up myself just as a way of thinking. What are feelings? Because, you know, sometimes if you see a flower, or, you know, you see a nice painting or something like that, you have a feeling associated with it. And I thought feelings are much more subtle, but still we know them. So I don't know, is it a mental thing or whatever it is, but it's more subtle. And the thing is, if there are a lot of loud emotions, intense going on, you don't really feel your feelings at that level. The subtlety is blocked out. It's like when there's a lot of noise, you don't hear something down there. Just to notice that about yourself. Suppression of emotion, negation, fear of it. Yeah, just... can you notice in your body what you're holding down, what you're holding in? I heard during the retreat people saying things like they felt like a block of ice or that kind of thing. Fear of feelings, fear of emotions. We living in the Western world, the dominant idea since Aristotle has been rationality and the mind at the expense of emotions. That's why there's so much suppression of emotions. There's fear of emotion. I mean, how often do we hear, you know, people are afraid to cry in public. It would be, you know, everybody would laugh at them or whatever. This kind of thing. So just even noticing that in yourself and seeing what you can do about it. But even, and also knowing that we live in a lopsided society, not society, in a lopsided culture in the Western world, where rationality dominates and drowns out an aspect of ourselves that we cannot kill. It's going to remain, and it causes a lot of pain. But so see, notice that in yourself and for yourself. Inquiry into actions. I suppose all you can do things like asking yourself, well, why do I do what I do? Why am I doing this today now? It might be something like you've made... for me, it was easier to look at things that weren't major things, if you know what I mean, kind of daily, mundane things. So it might be something like I made a lunch appointment with somebody, and then I would say, now, why am I going to have lunch with that person? What do I want? Because you don't do something unless you want something. There's a purpose to it or a goal. Am I doing this out of some kind of duty? Because this is a legacy relationship and, you know, that's what I do. Am I doing this because this is a person that always gives me great lot of feedback and loves to see me, so I'm getting lots of attention and feed, whatever it is. So it, just things like that, asking yourself, why am I actually doing this? And as I said, I mostly use just mundane daily things, but sometimes bigger things. You know, it might be, well, why am I doing this degree? I already have 3 degrees, and here I am committing to another 2 years to do another degree. What do I think I'm going to get from this? What am I expecting? What do I want from it? So what's my goal? What's my motivation? And a lot of times you just get to notice, well, why am I going to the shop? I'm going to the shop because food needs to be in the house or whatever. You don't have to think about it a second time. That's what you're doing. Now, supposing you're going to the shop because you might want to go around shopping and spending money and go down to the mall and look at clothes and jewellery and all the rest. That's a different kind of going to the shop. What are you looking for there? Not so much to get anything as to feed some kind of... I don't know. I don't know what you'd be doing going to the shop looking for clothes, but I know an awful lot of people do it. Window shopping, and you know, it's a hobby that people have. So what are you avoiding doing when you're doing that? Because everything you're doing is taking time out of all other possibilities with time. We all only have a limited amount of time and a limited amount of energy. And are we going to dissipate it on frivolous things? Or do we have a higher goal, or do we have something that's really more important, that we've figured out something is really an opportunity for me that's so amazing, and am I dissipating my energy on things and not going after this? And do it now, do it today. So if you're going to the shop to go buying fancy clothes or whatever, those 3 hours could be spent doing something. That's doing it, as opposed to thinking about it and postponing it and whatever. If you really mean it, you'll do what's most important, what you value most, and use what time and energy you have towards the main thing. Am I near the end? I am. Because I don't remember how much I did that. I stopped. I mean, I could probably go on forever fitting in things here, but anyway, this is what was I thinking when I was here? what I was just thinking about, you know, noticing that the ego or the I is, it's robotic, it's programmed, it keeps on doing its thing, and any kind of self-inquiry or praying or meditating or coming to retreats or anything like that, it's conscious action. You're doing something deliberately and consciously, as opposed to following a program that you've been running for years. And what I was trying to say was that conscious action is of a higher level. It's closer to, do you remember our other one here, the self? It's closer to that. So the work that you're doing is coming at this level. It's kind of here. And basically what it's doing, it's breaking holes in this big defense mechanism so that it's more porous. And when that happens then, the... You know, remember the very first one I put where there's a line going up, a connection, a thread, we'll call it, going up to God. But if this is so tightly closed or whatever, nothing is coming through from it, or at least we think nothing is coming through because we can't sense it or we can't feel it. So conscious action is about breaking holes in this while keeping yourself functional and everything. You know, just living an ordinary daily life and managing what you need to do in the world. And if it gets too, if you find yourself getting, doing too much or too much happening and becoming dysfunctional and not able to cope, I would say take a break for a couple of days or rest back from it. You know, if there's too much coming through, because things like that used to happen to me. It was just take a break, not going to do any more today. But you do have to start out, I think, with making a real effort and doing everything you can and see where it takes you. So I don't know how I'm doing on time, Nathan.
You've got 19 minutes.
19 minutes. Well, since I have nothing else to say, I think you better ask me questions. Did anybody want to make any comments or anything about that?
You didn't speak about dreams. That was.
I just put it there. From when I was young, I always thought that dreams, that it was amazing that you have dreams. Do you know, isn't it just an amazing thing that we have dreams? Do you not all think that it's utterly amazing? And I just thought it was entertaining, really. And I used to love if people told their dreams, because the sheer creativity and imagination of them. And then I came across the idea, of course, of dream analysis and this kind of thing. But what attracted me most was Carl Jung. And Jung said that the symbols in the dream are really the symbolism is where the real message, or where something will get through. And he also said that there's two kinds of dreams, which is significant dreams, which will have symbolism. They're coming from the deep, something like that, or from the self, from the unconscious. And then there's superficial dreams, which, you know, you're just about daily life. You know, you can even see your own mind processing. You know, you met somebody yesterday and he was doing something that somebody else was doing. Just that kind of thing. But I would say that when you have a significant dream, you're not going to forget it. This is what I began to find. Because, you know, we have dreams all the time, and yet there'll be some that you'll still remember after time. So a big part of Carl Jung's work was he realised that there were certain symbols, or there was a vocabulary of symbols that existed in the world. And no matter, regardless of what culture a person came from, these certain symbols came up. And he referred to them as universal symbols. You know, everybody has some kind of a symbol for mother, or an image that represents mother or motherhood. And he also said that we have our own personal symbols. And this is over a period of time beginning to... It's like getting to know what are your own personal symbols. For instance, a personal symbol that I had was rats. A rat. Now, if you look up any symbol dictionary, and I've even done this recently, there'd be maybe a little couple of notes about a rat, but a rat in a dream, and I always knew it meant something to me. I didn't know what it meant. Much later, actually, I realised that a rat represented what I resisted in the world. Everything that was ugly, that you avoided, it was the symbol in me of what I resisted. What was distasteful and ugly and everything. And in fact, a couple of weeks before the end of my path, I had a dream, and I knew it was significant, in which myself and my dog were walking on the beach, and there was a rat, a big water rat, and there was this really dirty gully, exactly the kind of thing that I would have avoided. And so it was something like, well, what are you going to do? Turn back? Or are you going to continue on? So I continued on, and I was thinking about the dog. What will I do if the dog starts running down to play with the rat? But as it happened, the rat was doing his thing over there. The dog just looked at him and went off, did his thing, and I continued on. It turned out when I got this dirty, you know, the dirty part, there were actually steps for me to step across. And I knew that it meant that I had finally accepted. I'd stopped resisting the world as it is. But for all those years, the rat was there, and I didn't know what it was. And I hated when rats came in dreams. They were... So that was a personal symbol for me that I had come to recognise. And it doesn't appear to be a universal symbol, because when I read, as I said, the stuff, it doesn't come up. There are... You know, if you get a golden key, if you have a dream and you're handed a golden key, I can't imagine that anybody wouldn't think of the key to the kingdom of heaven. Or if it's just there on the table or whatever. Nowadays, people tell me some of their dreams, and I'm just in awe of what's going on. I don't know that dreams... I don't know that they move the path forward or anything like that. But what I did find, because I trusted them, I was being given news bulletins from the deep. I knew what was going on with me, and it was very steadying for me. I knew there was something going on, first of all, that there was movement, inner movement, whatever was going on. And I was being given, as I said, news bulletins as to what was happening. And that was very helpful to me. Do I want to say anything else about dreams? I don't know, if you want to ask me any questions, because we have a bit of spare time and I haven't thought of anything.
So I want to ask you a question. So what was the final... final... What was the key, finally? Like, what was the final thing that broke? Or made you... Or pushed... You got pushed...
Over the edge.
Yeah, over the edge, yeah.
No, I got invited over the edge. And an invitation that I couldn't resist. That was really how it felt. And I just tell a little bit of what happened on the night. I had gone to bed. I had finished a solitary retreat, and I was all ready to go home. And I had a lot of art. We called them satori's. I didn't know what this word meant, but years before, well, for five or a number of years, I was having what I called mystical experiences, small ones and big ones and whatever. And when this started happening first, I was a bit frightened and upset. I didn't know was it going mad or not. But I remembered I had read the lives of the saints. I'd be reading that kind of thing when I was young. And suddenly, oh my God, this is what they were writing about. So I had a lot of stuff like that happening, and I was very familiar with it, and I didn't pay too much attention to it, really. I just got used to it. And during that week, the sparkly lights around and things like that. And so I'd gotten into bed, and there's a light over there, like a little small light, and I was looking to see where the curtains closed, and this light turned into a ball this size. And I still didn't bother with it. I looked at the other curtain to make sure it was closed for the morning and not be waking me up. And it came as a ball of light in front of me, which was somewhere down there. And then I had to look at it. I absolutely had to look. And as I did, it opened up into a tunnel. And the tunnel came closer to me. I'm still looking at this. I'm having a look around to see what's going on. And this tunnel came closer to me. And it was right in front of me. And there were some kind of entities. They were not, I don't know whether they were humans or people, I do not know what they were. And the invitation to come in, I was from this part of me, was invited into it. And it was like, as I began to make a movement with that invitation, the tunnel just came back and went over me. I just went into it. It overtook me, is a better way to say it. And there I am, and everything had changed. And the interesting thing was, I recognized what I was. I did not, I would say things like self-realization or whatever, but the most honest thing for me to say was, I recognized myself. And I don't know whether I thought it, I find something unusual or different or not. This was more familiar than me, if I could say that. And then there were things that happened after that. Was that the question you were asking? Did I answer you? What did I find that I was? Well, all of creation comes out of what I am. I don't say things like I am God. Whenever I hear some people saying that, those words are distasteful for me. What we are is more than any of us could ever imagine, I think. So much so that it's even hard to talk about it. I mean, all I try to talk about is how do you facilitate this possibility happening for you. That's about the only way I can talk about it for now. Because what we are was before this body was born and will be after this body is gone. I'll put it in another language that maybe might be helpful to somebody, because when you say these things in different ways, sometimes a particular phrasing helps somebody. I could put it this way. There's consciousness, which is God, self, real, whatever you want to call it. And there's the objects in consciousness. Consciousness is not dependent on the objects. The objects arise and pass. The objects are everything. It's everything. You cannot name anything that isn't an object. And the objects arise out of consciousness and dissolve back into consciousness. And I suppose when I say that for a human being, we think, well, you know, there's mountains and there's a kitten. One of them arises and lasts longer, and the other one arises and passes more quickly. That's just the human perception. That's just the way our minds work. Like a whole scene comes up and passes. But the objects are dependent on consciousness. Consciousness is not dependent on the objects. And what we are is consciousness.
Yes.
Dan.
Could you speak a little bit about the chakras and inner energy transformation that you told me that you experienced and how this comes?
I don't know the chakras. I mean, of course, I've read books on them and so on. I don't remember the order of them or anything like that. But I had a lot of stuff go on in my body for 5 years. Now, I didn't know it would be for 5 years until it stopped. So, at the time, it just seemed like one damn thing after another. But I used to Google. When I had so many symptoms of stuff, I would Google them. And I always got back Kundalini and menopause. Now, it so happened... it so happened I was also going through menopause, which the onset of it was dramatic and sudden. So I couldn't tell what was what. But I seemed to be having a rather exciting menopause as far as my doctor was concerned, because she didn't know anything about Kundalini. And, just any kind of things. I mean, at one stage I went through a phase of every night when I sat down, if I say a pain in this side of my body, it was like that I leant over like this, there was a ball of agony. And I would have never have used, even childbirth or anything else, I would not have used the word agony. Because it was long, and can it say intense, you could poke around here and do everything, it had no effect on it, and it wouldn't be there during the day. And of course I always tested things in terms of, is there something wrong with my body, or was there something wrong with my spleen or something, if I go to the doctor and they scan me and all the rest. I mean, she surely thought I had become a hypochondriac. And nothing would show up, and then it would pass and something else, and then at one stage, I mean, this, maybe a few years later, I don't know how long in time, because it seemed to me there were periods of absolutely nothing happening, and I didn't notice that there was a progression. So it happened to me one night that I thought I was having a heart attack, and myself and my husband were sitting there, and he was saying to me, well, do you think I should call the ambulance? We'll wait now. And I don't suffer from indigestion. And is it going down your arm? And you have a good colour. This went on for several hours. And, you know, after several hours, we hadn't called an ambulance or anything. It was like, well, it hasn't got any worse. And it seems to be easing. And, you know, you seem to be... We decided I was fine. And if anything happened during the night, we'd phone. So just things like that that were inexplicable. But and it ended, I'll just tell you this, the last 9 months with constant activity around the head. I never had a headache or anything like that, but it was as if the brain was trying to push the top off my head, or what it must be, the brain stem, I don't know whether it had turned solid or was expanding, I don't know what. And it was as if, without hands, if you could imagine, as if there were hands that were, you know, doing those kinds of things. So I can only think that that's what's meant when you read in Indian literature about subtle energies. But anyway, it stopped dead the week before the end. And I didn't notice it had stopped dead for a while, you know, because I didn't notice the absence of it. But I noticed that my body was completely clear and none of these things, and they've never come up since. So then there was a woman, she came to a retreat in Ireland, and she kept saying to me, how did it start? When did it start? All right. And I had no clue when it started. This just started up. But she said to me, did you ever get a bad pain in your leg or something? And I said to her, well, a thing did happen one time when I felt as if I had been shot in my hip. a gunshot in my hip. And I'd always had, you know, lower back problems that would come and go, but this was much sharper, much more intense. And it was in my hip rather than my back. Now, at the time, I rationalized it, oh, God, the back must be getting worse or whatever. But I was in such pain that I basically lay on the couch for a couple of days. And I remember my daughter came to visit, and she was like, oh, I've never seen anyone in such pain. And that passed. But I don't know when it passed, maybe about a week, and then stuff started happening in this part of my body, and I didn't connect them. It was only with hindsight, looking back, that I could say Kundalini energy took 5 years to move up through my body, right up to the top. I had some idea that Kundalini would be like a shooting energy up your back, it'd shoot up in a second or something, but that was the way it happened with me. And it's and I can identify what was Kundalini as opposed to menopausal stuff by the absence of them. Menopausal stuff is much more dense, you know, much more felt in the body. This was outside the body, but so entangled, I don't know, so entangled in the body that I felt it in the body, but it wasn't off the body. Just that, Dan, I don't know if that's any help to you or not. I don't talk about this kind of thing much because I know that there are a lot of practices that are all about, you know, getting the Kundalini going, and I don't know. And if it's up as far as here, you're at stage four, and there's six stages and whatever. They're all about that. I just didn't pay any attention to it. I just thought that it was, well, Art did say to me, you know, keep your eye on the ball. That's a side effect. It was very, very helpful to have that said, because I think I could have gotten distracted if I didn't have somebody to say that to me. I could have started thinking, oh, I'm comparing notes and how do you do this. But the other thing is, I never did anything conscious to trigger this Kundalini stuff. It happened. Yeah, I wasn't at any kind of meditation or, you know, kind of stuff that's about getting good. It just started happening. And I, as I said, I didn't know what it was. And it's only with hindsight I can see that over 5 years. I know exactly when it started, and it finished the week before. The week, basically, when I went on silent retreat, it was absent for that week. I think Nathan is suggesting we have coffee or tea. And I'll come back afterwards and answer questions if anybody have any. And if not, I'll be the real school teacher. You can get out early.